This season and the rhythm of the church life throughout history has been called Advent. And Advent is just a word that we don't use that often now, but Advent is the arrival or the appearance of a very notable person or event or thing, right? Advent means something is going to appear, that something is going to happen. That, of course, in this case, we're talking about the advent of Christ, the Messiah of our Lord Jesus, the appearing or the he's finally going to come. And Advent comes with this sense of anticipation like I said, no one really gets except children, I think. I mean, children are so good at having anticipation, expectation, and hope, aren't they? I mean, they no matter what can be going on, no matter what's going on, no matter what's going on around them, they can just be taken, overtaken by this sense of the future and expectation. I mean, maybe getting something, you know, Jovi now is on this kick with an air rifle, and no matter what can be going on, he can just, you know, mention something about this air rifle. You know, just this all-consuming sense of something big is going to happen, right? And that's kind of what this part of the year in church history has always been about, this Advent season. But today I want to start looking at, look at this picture, okay? Anybody know where that's at?
Grayson Highlands.
Yeah, Grayson Highlands, that's cool. Mountains have always been like this big part of the human experience, right? Mountains and just their topography have shaped, from a practical standpoint, you know, where people settled and where they lived and what resources were available, to like where you go. I mean, who's going to the vacation to, there's nothing wrong with Kansas, but who's going to the vacation of just the middle of Kansas just to see the scenery of the cornfields? Yeah, to see your son, exactly. But you didn't go there and just take in the spectacle of the endless flat fields, right? Where do people go on vacation? You go to the ocean, New York City, yeah. But there's a lot of people that come here, believe it or not, we're kind of used to it. And, you know, the Grayson Highlands and that, just to take in the scenery of the mountains. I mean, the mountains, they're special, right? And there's something about mountains that kind of, I don't know, they have an effect on you. Look at this next picture. What's this? No. This didn't work. That didn't work. Fuji. Yeah, it's Fuji. Why would we know that? I mean, even we'll name two or three other mountains. You know, Kilimanjaro is also very distinctive, and Everest, of course, is very tall. But why in the world would we know any of those? Because it's a big deal, right? It's a big deal. This is a very iconic picture of Mount Fuji in Japan. And in Japan, in their culture, this is a sacred place. It has been for centuries and centuries, up until like 17th century, and women weren't even allowed to go to the top of it, right? You know, for whatever reason. And the first non-Japanese person to ever go to the top was in the 19th century, because it was just this sacred place, and it's just a very iconic image, just sacredness. You know, mountains affect people, right? And there's something about them that you're just drawn to. Whether it's the ruggedness or the remoteness or whatever the case may be, there's something about mountains that affect people, and something about mountains that, I don't know, I think it's something just kind of clicks, something instinctually with people and with mountains. As we get into this text for the day, in the lectionary, in Isaiah 2, so this is the vision that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be the highest of all, the most important place on earth. This vision, this word that Isaiah saw, says, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be the highest of all, the most important place on earth, the most iconic image of all, the most captivating place in the world. It's going to be where God resides. It will be raised above the other hills, and people from all over the world will stream there to worship. People from many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of Jacob's God. There he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths." come see how. So go back, please. Okay. Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of God's, of Jacob's God. There he will teach us his ways and we will walk in his path. So you start to get a little hint of this hopefulness in this vision that Isaiah saw, this anticipation. But it's much more striking sense of anticipation if you think about what's going on in his world and what he says just before this. This is Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 1 says, see how the faithful city, in other words, Jerusalem, where he lives, you know, this is the capital of the kingdom of Judah, where he is a prophet. See how the faithful city has become a prostitute. She was once full of justice. Righteousness used to dwell in her, but now murderers. Your silver has become dross. Your choice wine is diluted with water. Your rulers are rebels, partners with thieves. They all love bribes and chase after gifts. And they do not defend the cause of the fatherless. The widow's case does not come before them. The indictment of this people is corruption. And it goes on, and it talks a lot about how that they have corrupted even the worship of God into just a show, this meaningless nonsense and church services and sacrifices, while then they turn around and they just act like everyone else, and they don't, like it says here, they do not defend the cause of the fatherless. The widow's case is not care before them. They don't care about each other. Because they don't, since they don't care about each other and they don't care about God, God indicts them here in chapter 1 and says, I'm going to destroy this. You need to be purged. Who's this? And Sam, I'm not going to ask Sam because like, there's no way you can know this. Is there? Sam? No. Okay. This is Tilgath. All right. Good old Tilgath, right? He was one of the rulers of the Assyrian Empire, and he really kind of put it on the map. Not that the Assyrian kingdom was weak by any stretch necessarily. It was still kind of a big deal in the region here in the Levant, based in modern-day Syria. But Tilgath was a... He had a different name. I forget what it was, Poku or something like that. He was just a general, basically, and a governor in one of the provinces. But he saw an opportunity. There was some conflict and basically a little bit of a civil war going on within the leadership. There was a king that died, and there was a. He saw an opportunity to insert himself. So this general changed his name to this kingly lineage and took the helm of the Assyrian Empire. And, man, he just destroyed everyone around him, okay, to the point they even conquered, Babylon. They were a big, big deal. And he's the first guy, that in a big way used forced deportations as an empire strategy. You know, we talked about this before here, and it plays a big role in the Bible, what goes on in the Bible, because he would go and he would conquer a territory, and he would deport some of the leaders and some of the, the most important people. Civic leaders, military leaders, religious leaders. He would deport those people out of that area, right? And so the conquered territories would be sort of in a state of chaos, and they would look to their overlords in the empire to stabilize things and to run things correctly, right? It's pretty daggone smart, right? But he did that all over the place, right? And eventually he came to look at this. 2 Kings chapter 15 says, Pekah, son of Remaliah, began to rule over Israel. This is the kingdom of Israel in the 52nd year of King Uzziah's reign in Judah. King Uzziah, the year King Uzziah died was when Isaiah started becoming a prophet, right? He reigned in Samaria 20 years. But Pekah did what was evil in the Lord's sight. He refused to turn from the sins that Jeroboam, son of Nebat, had led Israel to commit. They had just gone way away from the vision God had for them as a people. But during Pekah's reign, King Tiglath, did I say Tilgath or Tiglath earlier? I don't even know. Okay, oh, it's Tiglath. King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria attacked Israel again. He captured the towns of, Ejon and Abel Beth Makkah, Genoa, Kadesh, and Hazor. He also conquered the regions of Gilead, Galilee, I can pronounce that one, and all of Naphtali. Now, where are these places? You ever heard of Gilead before? What about Galilee? Heard of that? Yeah. It's getting close to home if you're in Judah, right? And he took the people to Assyria as captives. Then Hoshea, son of Elah, conspired against Pekah, the king of Israel. Hoshea was kind of this puppet ruler for Assyria and assassinated him. He began to rule over Israel in the 20th year of Jotham, son of Uzziah. So what was going on in this region during this time of the prophecy? We just read this from Isaiah. It was just turmoil and upheaval. You know, the most powerful armies in the world were right there. They're in Galilee, right? You know, there's towns falling left and right. Their kingdoms, you know, being crushed and conquered by this superpower, right? Total upheaval. But then Isaiah 2 will continue on in this vision in Isaiah 2. It says, "For the Lord's teaching will go out from Zion. His word will go out from Jerusalem. The Lord will mediate between peoples and will settle disputes. They will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will no longer fight against nation or train for war any more." That would sound really good, wouldn't it? And if it was upheaval and turmoil all around you, the armies of the superpower were on your doorstep. The Lord will mediate between peoples and settle disputes. They will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will no longer fight against nation or train for war anymore. So you would like, I mean, this would be a welcome message, wouldn't it? And Isaiah also says this, that a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, and from his roots a branch will bear fruit. Of course, it's talking about Christ. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together. And a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together. And the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den. And the young child will put his hand in the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Look at this next picture. Does any of this stuff, they will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Or they will beat their swords into plowshares. All right? God fixing everything. But is it true? You know? Did it work out like that for the people Isaiah was talking to? Did it or did it not? The people, Isaiah, you know, his audience. No, it didn't. What happened to the people Isaiah was talking to? He was talking to them as, right, he was prophesying as the kingdom of Israel. Okay, there had been this split, this civil war between Judah and the people of Israel. The Israelites were split into two nations. The kingdom of Judah, much smaller in the south, and then... the kingdom of Israel in the north, right? Well, those people, those Israelites, the kingdom of Israel, they were being destroyed. They were being consumed by Assyria as he was speaking here there in chapter 2, right? He's saying, you know, the mountain of God is going to become the most important place on earth. People are going to stream to the mountain of God, right? And God's going to be there. He's going to set up shop. You're going to beat your swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks or whatever. Did it happen for those people? Not at all. What happened to them? The northern kingdom carried off into Assyria, destroyed. What happened to the southern kingdom in Judah? You guys have been here long enough, you know this. What happened to them? Say one word. Babylon. Even, you know, even greater power came and took them over and carried them off, this forced deportation strategy also into Babylon, right? They were there for a generation, right? So, I mean, if you were listening to Isaiah's words about this promise of the mountain of God being raised up and peoples of the earth streaming into it and God mediating all disputes between people, and you were to go kind of like this little girl, oh yeah, and then beat your sword into a plowshare, you would look kind of foolish, wouldn't you? You would have looked kind of foolish to your contemporaries, right? Because it wasn't true. It didn't happen, right? The point is, it's not whether it happened. Okay? Look at it this way. Let's put it this way, okay? Think about when you were a kid. Can you remember as a kid being very, having a great sense of anticipation for the holidays? Yeah. I can remember really, really, really enjoying going to my grandparents' houses and being mostly with all the cousins. You know, the gifts were a positive, but, you know, they weren't that big a deal at the grandparents' houses, right? I mean, the real Christmas happened at mom and dad's, and they got you, you know, your real stuff. You would go to grandma's and you would get some pretty cool stuff and a pack of socks, right? But it was the people that were there, these cousins that you hardly ever got to see, right? And you would go and you would scream and play and, you know, act like crazy people, right? And it was just this big deal. I can just remember really anticipating. We had some cousins that lived in North Carolina that we got to see in summer and then here at Christmas. And it was just this big deal to see your cousins. And so you would be thinking about this. You have these weeks, and it seemed like years leading up to Christmas, right? Because you would start celebrating it at school. You'd make the little paper chains to hang everywhere. And, you know, all these little rituals, and you would remind yourself about Christmas and what's going to go on. And a huge part of that's going to your grandparents and see your cousins. So this, like I said, kids are so good at anticipating things, right? And what frame of mind are you in when you're anticipating something so joyful and so good and so positive, like, you know, going to your grandparents and playing with your cousins? What frame of mind are you in? Are you happy or are you sad? Huh? Yeah, you're joyful. You know, and it's like this baseline of joy. Right? Well, you know, this is going to happen. We are going to the grandparents. We're going to see Jason and Heather, right? And it's kind of this baseline that everything else, you, of course, you have your ups and downs throughout these weeks leading up to Christmas, but still this baseline of joy because you have this anticipation, this, you know, this trust that this good thing is going to happen, right? And so that anticipation itself, not the event. The event, really, looking back, it's not that big a deal, right? I remember far more about what it meant, what it felt like for all those weeks and days leading up. I mean, a lot of times at Christmas, that was kind of almost anticlimactic, right? It's so fun going all, you know, spending all this time leading up to this, and you get to this, and it's somewhat, well, now it's over, and there's this kind of letdown after it's over. So that anticipation, that hope, that joy. But now, what other kind of anticipation do you remember as a kid? And we'll go to the next picture. Who's ever heard these words? Just wait until. Oh, man, that's great. Worked out great. Just wait until your dad gets home. You ever heard that, Sam? Yeah. Yes. That's a different sort of anticipation, isn't it? Yeah. And that's kind of the same deal, too. You know, oh, man, you did something wrong, you broke something, or, you know, You punched your brother, right, Sarah? You know, and just wait until your father, wait until your mother gets home. Wait until your mother hears about this. Wait until your dad gets home. Now, what's that anticipation like? It's just dread. And see, now there's that baseline of dread, and the rest of the day you can try to take your mind off of whatever's going to happen, right? But there still is this baseline of dread. This, and that colors, that affects all the rest of the day, doesn't it? Then when you get to that event, you know, a lot of times, you know, it works out better than you thought. In any case, it's over, right? But that anticipation, that dread, that's a new, different sort of a baseline. That's a very different sort of anticipation. What you anticipate affects everything about your life. What you anticipate, what you are looking forward to, what you are looking ahead to, affects everything about you. Okay? So, while no, it didn't happen exactly like that for Judah, while people haven't all beaten their swords into plowshares, well, there's a very important word here. It's yet. God hasn't finished with this world yet. He hasn't finished with you yet. And what you choose to spend your life anticipating will affect everything about you. You know, I don't know how everything in this world is going to turn out, right? But the smart money is on God. The safe bet is on the one who made it. And he has said things like, this world will be filled with the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea. He has promised to take care of us. He has promised to fix this world. And it is very important for us to be in tune with ourselves in this world and to be able to recognize what's going on. You know, one thing I can, because to have a proper hope for the future, you need to be aware of what the issues are that God is going to fix. You know, I can remember, you know, kids are really good about, or bad, about kind of inventing their own religion or spirituality. You know, the kids, if you're trying to, you know, I feel for these teachers back here, because you try to teach kids something about God and you don't know what they're going to latch onto in their minds and invent this whole understanding around this one, you know. Do you get what I'm saying? So I'm not saying I was taught this as I was a kid, but I can remember my understanding of heaven and God fixing everything as a kid was, I was really bored with that. I didn't really look forward to, you know, clouds, and I do remember a preacher saying, heaven's going to be just like this forever. Woo! You know, during this church service. I'm like, man, I hope it's a long time before that happens. You know, so the understanding I invented as a child was of a eternal church service. You know, not too cool, right? But when you think about the reclamation of all things, of God fixing me, of God fixing this cosmos, and you think about everything that is screwed up in this world we live in, you know, from addiction and poverty and sickness and broken relationships and destructive choices and warfare and the junk that's in my heart and the things that I think and the things that I say and the things that I do to hurt other people. All of that is what God is promising that He's going to fix. So go back. Yeah. So when we choose to live in anticipation, when we soak in these passages, these promises, these assurances for a remade world, all behold, the old are gone, and everything is made new. And we choose to live with that as our baseline. And it is a choice. It affects everything about our lives. We choose to trust. We dare to trust. It changes everything. And to me, it's an easy choice to make. It's a choice between this and that. And so how do you make that choice? What does it look like to live that sort of way? Romans chapter 13. It says, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. That owe no man nothing except your continuing obligation to love each other. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be. Whatever else you can come up with, whatever else exists, this is summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. So do this. Love each other. Understanding the present time. Because the hour has already come for you to wake up from your slumber. Because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. Even Paul says, I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's closer now than it was 5 minutes ago. And it's not this sense of dread for God coming back and taking you to an eternal church service, right? It's this night where we're at now. The darkness you see all around you, the darkness in your heart, the darkness in your life, the night is nearly over. And the day is almost here. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in carousing and drunkenness and sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. Rather, clothe yourselves with the presence of Christ. Do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh. So what's it look like to live a life shaped by hope, shaped by anticipation of God fixing this world? It looks like you make the choice to love each other and to put on the presence of Christ like a suit of clothes. So when you choose to not demand your way, when you choose to not get them back, you're choosing hope. When you're choosing to forgive, when you're choosing to move on, right? When you're choosing a second chance, choosing hope, right? When you're choosing to be generous, right? When you're choosing to give to somebody else, You're choosing hope. When you're choosing to serve somebody, when you're choosing to meet needs, you're choosing hope. When you choose thankfulness and gratitude, when you're choosing beauty and joy and praise, you're choosing hope. You're choosing to believe that God is actually going to do what He said He's going to do. Like I said, that is the safe bet. I'm going to close out with one more little passage. This is a song of ascents from Psalms. This is Psalms 120 through 130. I don't know. Anyway, there, some of them are songs of ascents, and it would be traditionally you would think about these songs when you're on a journey, or when you are making a pilgrimage for one of the festivals to Jerusalem, which was on this prominence on this mountain. You would sing these songs, and they're very much meant to be sing these songs as you go up the mountain or as you're on the journey. Or you would send this out as kind of a traveling blessing to someone who is on a journey. And I like this one because as we start to think about these things, when you're talking about what God is going to do to fix the world, and we think about all these problems that are around us, it is so easy to fall into the despair end of the anticipation equation. Because for so many people, and so many people around here, you have no reason whatsoever to believe that anything's good is going to come out of this thing called life. Right? You have no reason to believe that God is ever going to do anything for me or for those people or for this situation. These are deep waters, right? And it's over my head. I don't know about you, but it's in a little bit over my head. But that's okay, because it's not about me, and it's not about my head, and whether it's over or underwater. It's about a God. It's about a big God who is incredibly good, who is going to move in ways in my life and in your life and in this world, and you or I cannot possibly imagine. Let's all read this together. What do you think? Start there in verse 1, out loud. I lift my eyes up to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. Where does our help come from? Our help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And may we anticipate that help. May we always turn our eyes to the hills.